Brittany Gillespie is a registered nurse at Ascension Columbia St. Mary's Hospital in Milwaukee. And like a lot of us, she first learned about the coronavirus on the news.
I remember being cautiously optimistic that this was truly going to stay in China. It sounds so stupid, but I really, yeah.
But on March 12, 2020, everything changed.
I myself gowned up and realized that I was in a COVID room. This patient has, you know, actually has COVID, and it has come here, and it is in Milwaukee.
You see, Brittany works in the intensive care unit at Ascension Columbia St. Mary's. Like a lot of other hospitals across the country, ICUs became the primary centers of care for those first wave of COVID patients.
And then I was off for a few days. Let's say I was off for 3 days. By the time I came back in 3 days, 36 beds were filled with all COVID patients.
And Ascension Columbia St. Mary's got hit hard. In fact, it was the first hospital in the city of Milwaukee to be overwhelmed by COVID patients. Beds filled up, supplies ran low, and the growing number of sick who had come down with this new disease required constant care from the hospital staff.
So you had to be very prepared before you walked into the COVID rooms, because once you were in the room, you could be in the room for one to 2 to 3 hours if you really had no idea, because these patients were just so medically complex. It could take 6 nurses and 2 doctors just to stabilize them, and on a 12-bed ICU unit, that's all of your staff. And then once that patient was stable, the next patient would do that same exact thing, and it would take, you know, all of the staff. So
the conditions stretched Brittany and her coworkers thin. There were days when ICU staff did not even have a chance to eat. After a few days, Brittany stopped packing a lunch altogether and just carried protein bars with her to snack on between patients. But what Brittany says stands out to her the most about those early days of the pandemic was the disconnect between how COVID-19 felt and how it sounded.
Despite being the busiest that we had ever been as an ICU, the unit was abnormally quiet in the hallways because all of the nurses were in rooms for hours at a time and all of the doors had to be closed for infection control. So I remember one time I walked out of my patient's room and I was the only one out of a room alone in a hallway. And it was a very eerie feeling. I truly felt like I was in the eye of a storm. It was so quiet, but I knew there was like buzzing and whirling and craziness around me. And I stood there for a moment and I just like absorbed that feeling because I had never felt that before. And I remember I prayed for the first time in a few years. And I just remember praying that at least some patients would survive. So I will never forget that moment.
Ultimately, Brittany only worked for a handful of days during this first wave of the coronavirus pandemic. 3 weeks after the first COVID patient came to Columbia St. Mary's, Brittany herself came down with the disease and remained sick for the next 3 months. Though she is thankfully now much better, COVID still very much remains with her, both personally and professionally.
And then I do talk in the past tense, but I wanted to point out that this is a description of the pandemic at its peak, but it's also a reality in all the hospitals still to this day. This is still happening. I'm not the only nurse that this has happened to.
Dr. Pandemics can often seem like a constellation of inconveniences. Some of us have only experienced the coronavirus by the way it's disrupted our daily lives. But Brittany's story reminds us that pandemics are, at their core, medical crises, ones that dramatically impact the health and well-being both of those who got sick and those who take care of them. Doctors and nurses faced a similar struggle back in 1918. When the great influenza pandemic struck the city over 100 years ago, hospitals became overrun with the sick, and medical professionals themselves became ill. How Milwaukee's medical community navigated the disease is both a testament to how much the medical profession's ethic of care has not changed, and also a story of just how far science and medicine have come. From the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee's Department of History, I'm Chris Cantwell, and in partnership with the Milwaukee County Historical Society, this is The Healthiest City, a podcast about Milwaukee and its pandemics. So last week on the show, we talked about how Milwaukee Public Health Commissioner George C. Ruland shepherded the city through the pandemic through a series of shutdown orders and public health measures. But he still also had to manage the treatment of tens of thousands of patients who came down with the disease. Our pod historian Christina Greve has the story.
Milwaukee resident Josephine Gottschalk was 11 years old when she came down with the flu. Her granddaughter, Susan Gottschalk, says that her grandmother never forgot being rushed to the hospital.
She had a really high fever, and they just couldn't bring the fever down, and they took her.
But what Susan remembers most about her grandmother's memories of being ill were the hallucinations.
And she would scare us with this because she'd get quite animated. I mean, I'm sure she really remembered it vividly in her mind, but she would go on about seeing these bottles. She would say there were fat ones, thin ones, tall ones, short ones, and they all had a face.
Such hallucinations usually only accompanied those who had a severe case of the flu. High fevers can sometimes cause the mind to do weird things. However, according to Dr. Carla Kearns, many cases for the 1918 flu likely looked pretty familiar.
Most people are going to present with the same symptoms that you'd be looking for. Fever, cough, being tired, body aches, all the kinds of things that we expect. They had the same ones.
Dr. Kearns is an assistant professor of medical ethics at the University of Kansas Medical Center, and she explains that it was only when the flu began to really attack the lungs that one's case can go from common to fatal.
What severe cases would be folks who had difficulty getting out of bed, whose lips started to turn blue because they were not getting enough oxygen, and that could be a blockage of mucus that potentially they could cough out. The folks who ended up with fluid inside the lungs, there wasn't a lot that they could do for them, but it's not like they had ventilators.
Coughing. It's what made the 1918 flu both deadly and transmissible. The virus's assault on the lungs made coughing its most common symptom, which in cities like Milwaukee had the potential to lead to a massive outbreak. The quickness and severity of Health Commissioner George Ruland's orders certainly helped Milwaukee to curtail the pandemic, but the flu's contagiousness still ultimately led to an estimated 30,000 Milwaukee County residents to catch the disease. This reality forced Milwaukee to quickly have to deal with its sick, and in particular, make sure the city's healthcare infrastructure could handle the epidemic. Despite the public health improvements made by the city's Socialist Party earlier in the decade, Milwaukee still had fewer hospitals than most other cities of comparable size. Milwaukee County Historical Society archivist Kevin Abbing explains,
when the Spanish flu hit Milwaukee, they had to take steps to expand the available hospital space because those handful of hospitals, I mean, they quickly, you know, were at capacity and, you know, sometimes over capacity. And so they needed the space desperately to treat people that were coming down with a flu.
To address the city's hospital shortage, Health Commissioner George Ruland received $15,000 from the Common Council and another $15,000 from the County Board. And with that money, they were able to purchase a vacant house once owned by the Neunemacher family on the corner of what is now 17th and West Wisconsin. There, the city developed an isolation hospital for the sick, along with transforming parts of the Milwaukee Auditorium into a care facility. But even with the expanded medical facilities, the city still had to staff these locations. And in further complicating the city's response, many Milwaukee doctors and nurses were overseas engaging in another struggle, World War I.
A good chunk of the able-bodied physicians in Milwaukee were in, serving in the military, overseas in France. And so there was a definite decrease in the number of physicians that were in Milwaukee. And of course there were nurses that were also serving, with hospitals overseas as well. And so the numbers were down, and that certainly had an impact.
To address the shortage of healthcare workers, the city enlisted teachers and school nurses to aid in the fight against the pandemic. Health Commissioner Rulin had closed schools to slow the spread of flu on October 14th. School teachers were then urged to volunteer their time as nurses' aides, and their crucial assistance was noted in the Milwaukee Sentinel.
Mrs. Reineking, superintendent at the Neunemacher, is wondering what she will do without the teachers, for their services have been invaluable as nurses' aides. It is hoped that those women of the city who have taken the first aid courses will respond to the call.
For the doctors and nurses still in Milwaukee, there was little they could do to treat the flu. Dr. Kearns explains.
So while they couldn't cure your flu, they couldn't make that go any better, they could make sure that you stayed hydrated, even before routine use of intravenous fluids. They could still have nurses watch over you and make sure that you got food and water as much as you needed. They could keep you sitting up in bed so you didn't choke on your spit and all the nasty stuff you were coughing up. They could make sure that you were warm and well-fed and give your body the best chance it could to heal. And they could keep infectious people away from healthy people.
In fact, keeping the sick away from the healthy was one of the primary functions that hospitals served during the pandemic. For the nurses working in the Neunemacher and other Milwaukee hospitals, they were unable to separate themselves from those infected with the flu. Many healthcare workers became sick themselves and could not continue working until they recovered, if they recovered.
When the flu did hit, the nurses and physicians, just like today, the people on the front line, they were exposing themselves to getting infected from the virus. I know that there were reports of, in Milwaukee hospitals, there was over 40 nurses that got sick. And at the county hospital, there was over 60 nurses that caught the flu. And so, there was a real risk involved in treating these people that were coming in. And, once they started getting sick, the number of caregivers definitely took a hit.
This combination of the flu's magnitude and the extended reach of the city's public health efforts greatly impacted those women and men who worked in hospitals and clinics. In the archives of the Milwaukee County Historical Society, for instance, lies the diary of Mattie Fuller, a young woman who married into Milwaukee's wealthy and well-connected Fuller family. In the fall of 1918, she worked as a nurse at Camp Grant Military Base outside the city of Rockford, Illinois, where the flu was running rampant.
October 4th, 1918. All of camp quarantined. Wear masks all day and night.
For most of the month of October, Fuller reported working 15 to 20 hours a day transporting and caring for the sick. And the work was more than just mentally and emotionally exhausting. It required a surprising amount of physical labor as well.
October 16th, 1918. Very heavy work. But some of the house guard have been detached to help us carry the stretchers. Makes things much easier.
Some days, Fuller recorded sleeping only a few hours a night in a hotel in her uniform. Other nights, she recorded not sleeping at all, haunted by the sounds of death outside her door.
October 8th, 1918. Still kept awake at hotel by rumble of trucks taking dead to depot.
Like a number of other nurses, doctors, and healthcare professionals, the flu soon found Maddie Fuller as well. When she returned to Milwaukee October 18th, sick with the flu, she expressed her frustration in her diary with some X's and exclamation points, as if she was censoring out a swear word. For the rest of October, Fuller's diary entries read only, "In bed," as she battled fever and pneumonia brought on by the flu. It was not until early November that Fuller was able to record in her diary.
Dressed and managed to get down to the first floor. Cheers.
So much of Fuller's story sounds familiar to the experiences of doctors and nurses we read about today. And in many respects, they are. But it's also important to note that people living in 1918 both viewed and understood disease very differently than we do. As Dr. Carla Kearns explains,
In the 1918 generation would have known young, healthy people who died of infections on a pretty routine basis, both children and adults. That freedom from infectious disease, the idea that you'll just take some penicillin and it'll be better, really was a transformation of human experience, but it wasn't one that this group had yet.
While medicine had not conquered infectious disease, there is still much that science understood in 1918. Dr. Kearns explained the medical knowledge that would have been available during the time of the Spanish flu.
So we knew that there were germs causing diseases. But what we didn't fully understand was all the different kinds of germs that there could be. So bacteria were something that could be seen under microscopes, but viruses could not.
This made it difficult to create an effective vaccine.
Certainly there would have been attempts to make a vaccine, but without the ability to isolate the virus, those vaccines would most likely have been for those other bacteria that were being identified in patients who had flu. But serum was very well established and vaccines were very well established in this period. So it was totally reasonable for people to think, well, surely they'll be able to find one for this.
The fact that doctors and nurses could not cure the disease did not stop people from trying. In fact, Milwaukee's newspapers were filled with a host of alternative remedies, cure-alls, and treatments. Milwaukee School of Engineering professor Frederick C. Wraith, for example, advised the sick to
take a hot bath for about 15 minutes or a hot mustard foot bath and then go to bed.
In fact, in ways not unlike our own moment, many Milwaukeeans turned to alcohol to deal with the pandemic. But in 1918, some thought it could actually cure the disease. According to one Dr. Abe Brenhard, who was quoted in the local press,
"I would not recommend the use of alcoholic liquors in fighting influenza in its lighter stages. It is a good stimulant, but there are several other stimulants which could be used in its stead. There has been a noticeable increase in the use of alcohol since the epidemic in Milwaukee."
While these homebrew remedies may have provided temporary relief or a placebo, medical professionals were adamant that self-treatment was dangerous. They continuously reminded the public that if they were experiencing any symptoms, they should notify a doctor or go to the hospital. Because the only remedy for the Spanish flu in 1918 was time. Rest and care offered by family members or medical professionals was the only way for the sick to get well. And while the technology certainly has changed, this principle remains true today. The impact of the Spanish flu went beyond those who got sick. Families were sometimes ripped apart by flu deaths. Kevin Abing recalls one tragic story he came across in his research.
There was a family that moved to Milwaukee, you know, only a couple months before.
They came to Milwaukee looking for wartime work in one of the city's many factories with a defense contract.
The entire family, and there was the husband, the wife, and I think there was like five children, and the entire family came down with the flu. And this poor family, I mean, they were living in squalid conditions. I mean, it's not like they were, in a comfortable, middle-class housing situation at all. I mean, they were living in the basement of some tenement building, and And unfortunately, the mother, the wife, she passed away. And the husband, I mean, he had absolutely no money to, you know, to pay for a funeral, for a casket. And so there was kind of a, you know, like a GoFundMe effort, more or less, to help raise funds to, you know, so that his wife wouldn't be buried in the Potter's Field out of the county grounds.
The family managed to raise enough money for the mother's burial, but their hardships were far from over.
But unfortunately, the kids, I mean, they had to break the family up because the father, you know, he was just too sick. He didn't have a job, and he couldn't take care of the kids. And so, you know, the kids were, you know, either put in an orphanage or farmed out to other families. And it was, I mean, you can't get any lower than that, you know, as far as, you know, the poor, the bad consequences of what this epidemic could do.
Like today, those that survived the flu still had to deal with the ramifications of an ongoing pandemic. Some who recovered had lingering symptoms. Others were forced to contend with the loss of loved ones. And as the next episode of The Healthiest City will reveal, Milwaukeeans also had to contend with the economic consequences of Health Commissioner Rulin's shutdown orders.
Christina Greve is getting her master's degree in public history at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. This episode is dedicated to the memory of her father, Craig Greve.
Under 29, men and women sure were dying from a disease, what the doctor called a flu. People died everywhere, death went creeping through the air. Father groaned, of the sick sure was saying.
Well, our show today was produced by Christina Greve, Ken Bartelt, and myself, with help from the students of History and New Media at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. This episode featured material from the Milwaukee County Historical Society and the digital archives of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Music for this episode is by Poddington Bear and the Blue Dot Sessions, while our concluding song is called The Influenza Blues and comes from a recording held by the American Folklife Center. Additional audio also comes from the Free Sound Archive. Ken Bartelt provided our voice for the Milwaukee Sentinel. Matthew Rohrer read for Dr. Frederick Wraith. Kyle Smith provided the voiceover for Dr. Bernard. And Kelly Cantwell served as our voice of Maggie Fuller. Thanks this week go out to Iram Ziudan and the ICU staff of Ascension Columbia St. Mary's in Milwaukee. And as always, an extra special thanks goes out to Kevin Abing at the Milwaukee County Historical Society for helping us access the archive, and to Judith Levitt, whose book The Healthiest City gave us both information and the title for our show. The Healthiest City is a production of the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee's Department of History and the Milwaukee County Historical Society. For more information, including photographs and documents from the era, check out milwaukeehistory.net/podcast. And as always, thanks for listening.
Everybody should address. Put a pain in every bone. A few days and you are gone to a place in the ground called a grave. It was God's almighty hand. He is judging this old man. Knocking down.